False flag supervillain operation is one thing, but ordering the deployment of a Class 6 quasi-sentient occult invocation engine is another matter entirely? You can suggest it, but I'm not listening. She mimes, hear no evil. This is a crisis, Dr. O'Brien. You don't get to say no. You're part of Operation Freudstein now, and you're going to play the violin sonata from the second act of that manuscript. You have got to be kidding. Convince me. Play for time. I fidget with the ring on my right hand, desperately aware that if Mary mistakes it for a routine itch, or is sleeping or otherwise distracted. Stanwyck gestures at the glass wall, separating us from the ops room. You've got all the pieces. 5 minutes time out won't hurt. Tell me what your hypotheses are, and I'll set you straight. Hypothesis? I shrug. You're part of a working group within ACPO, the Association of Chief Police Officers. A clearinghouse and information exchange between territorial forces, operating at the very highest level, with some staff seconded from other forces, that also undertakes operations directly on behalf of the Home Office. Your command has responsibility for a bunch of major security briefs. You run the Counter-Terrorism Command, what used to be Special Branch, among other things. You're therefore the logical person to put in charge of responding to the imminent threat to law and order posed by I check with my internal sensor. It grants permission for me to continue, which is in itself worrying. Sudden sharp spike in the prevalence of both ritual magic and informal paranormal powers, commonly interpreted by those on the receiving end as making them superheroes. She nods minutely, so I continue, listening for the caution of a still, small inner voice. You plotted the same graphs that my employers have been sweating over for the past few months. You saw the sudden upswing and worried that before long everyone would be casting fireballs, levitating, building space stations, and generally getting in the way of community policing. So you began looking for a solution to the problem, framed tightly as a superpowered public order issue. Then my people came along. Have you signed Section 3? She nods. I know who you are, she says, with a surprising level of quiet vehemence. SOE. Another wartime relic. Her cheek twitches. We are out of the unlawful activities business, Dr. O'Brien. We're part of the Home Office, not the Ministry of Defence. Unlike your employers, we attempt to do everything by the book. Sometimes we fail, and then it's time for professional standards and the IPCC to work out what went wrong. But the point is, we don't cut corners. I roll my eyes. Sure, and we deal with threats you can't handle. Existential threats. Your job is to enforce the law. But the law in question applies to human beings here on this earth. It doesn't work so well after a nuclear war, which is the only sane comparison for what my organization is responsible for heading off. That's where you're wrong. She gives me a brief feral smile and taps the disastrous letter again. It's lawful. It's signed by the Home Secretary herself. And I'm not willing to bet that my laundry warrant card can trump it. Short of getting it countersigned by the Queen, it doesn't go much higher than this. Civil Contingencies Act, Dr. O'Brien. It was drafted to govern exactly that sort of situation. Shit. She is, of course, technically correct. The CCA is the overarching piece of civil defence and disaster preparedness legislation that governs how the United Kingdom would be ruled in the aftermath of a nuclear war or an invasion by undead alien gods. She's got me banged to rights. And she continues remorselessly. You agree that it's my organisation's job to enforce the law, don't you? Where is she going with this? Yes. Well, we consider the outbreak of 3 to 5 Sigma superpowers to be a critical problem. An out-of-context problem for the practice of policing, if you're familiar with the term. Oh, God. We have to take preventative action to stop it from turning into a tidal wave of lawlessness. And we have to do it as soon as possible. before disasters like the EDL march in Oldham become daily occurrences. Your sock puppet, public relations superhero team, isn't going to provide a constructive role model for our superpowered youth. It's just going to be the butt of their jokes. Don't think it hasn't been tried before any number of times, during various panics over juvenile delinquency. We're facing Armageddon, Dr. O'Brien. We've got to head it off before it happens. A nightmare of lawless rioting lumpen proletariat with superpowers is just around the corner. You may be concerned with the defense of the realm, but I'm concerned with ensuring there's a realm left to defend. Aren't you exaggerating a bit? I ask. That's a mistake. Laura proceeds to deliver the smackdown in the shape of a canned 3-minute lecture on law and disorder in the big city. Our total overall detection rate is just 24%, Dr. O'Brien. Less than a quarter of reported crimes for which we get a confirmed clear-up. In some areas, offences against vehicles, burglary, theft and criminal damage. We're under 15%. In reality, most of those crimes are the work of a hardcore of serial offenders, so we get them eventually. But in the meantime, it creates a chilling climate. It creates the impression that we are institutionally incapable of preventing crime. Law-abiding citizens like yourself go about in a state of fear out of all proportion to the scale of the problem, fanned by the tabloid media. Meanwhile, real criminals feel empowered and invulnerable. If some of them subsequently become invulnerable in reality, we will have a desperately serious problem. Bad enough if they were to be robbing sleepy banks who pay insufficient attention to securing their vaults. She reaches into the folio and produces a police evidence baggie containing a pair of DLT tapes. Think of the climate of fear. We can't afford to let go for a split second, Doctor. We're all that stands between you and anarchy, red in tooth and claw. I know where Laura is coming from now. She's a member of the you-couldn't-handle-the-truth-slash-thin-blue-line-saving-you-from-drowning-in-a-sea-of-filth school of police opinion, which is all very well. But better policing and more powers to stop and search isn't going to protect us when the sleeper in the pyramid wakes up. That's not going to happen, I point out. I don't know if you've been briefed yet, but the superpowered are at risk of K-type dementia. The more power they use, the faster they're going to come down with... Doesn't matter, Doctor. A malevolent Five Sigma who succumbs to a neurodegenerative condition after 2 weeks is still a disaster. Her eyes widen slightly. Is Jim Gray at risk? I nod. Oh dear. We, the Laundry, have some experience in managing this condition. There are techniques that can reduce an occult practitioner's susceptibility. They may work for superpowers too. After all, they're just informal ritual practitioners with an intuitive-slash-somatic interface. But, if you want to tackle the superpowered, you need to build hospitals, not super dungeons. Nevertheless, she swallows, looking appalled. She's genuinely rattled, if I'm any judge of character at all. If I give full credit to what you're telling me, that just makes your willing participation in Operation Freudstein all the more important. Tell me more. I'm fascinated. Why the name? It's a portmanteau. The 20th century was bookended by the nightmares of Freud and Einstein. Freudstein is a high-profile awareness-raising exercise to show everyone just how dangerous a Five Sigma criminal can be. We can point to his activities and say, that's why we need these special contingency powers, before it's too late. For a project simulating a mad scientist whose goal is to provide the impetus and the mechanism for performing surgery on the collective subconscious of a nation, what could be more appropriate? I nod encouragement. Let me guess. This sonata you want me to play. It's from The King in Yellow, isn't it? The second act? Or the third? Yes. The assistant commissioner looks past me at something happening in the control room. You know the last night is being broadcast live. Audio on Radio 3 and television on BBC One. We can push this broadcast a bit further. We can tie into the backbone routers at Telehouse Docklands using the same interconnect GCHQ use for their MTI surveillance. And we can transparently redirect the DNS queries from any computer in the UK to point wherever we want them to. In a nutshell, we're going to piggyback your solo on every YouTube video session in the country. At the same time, we will push a playout update to Sky and Virgin, the satellite and cable monopolists for the UK. We won't get everyone, but a good 30% of the population should receive saturation coverage. Maybe even half. She smiles encouragingly. Just think. You'll have the biggest audience of any live event in Britain since the royal wedding. I frown. Her smile goes away. What's the payload? I ask. She leans forward. Peel's 9 principles of policing. The lightning grin comes out again. We're not stupid, you know. We know about the risks of installing a firmware upgrade in somebody's brain. So the core message is very simple. The police are the public, and the public are the police. I can hardly believe your organisation, been sitting on such an incredibly powerful tool for decades, and nobody's thought of doing this before. We're facing a crisis of law enforcement. Just getting a third of the population to work with us, including a third of the superpowered, is going to go a huge way towards mitigating the... She keeps on wittering away. But I am half past listening. I make pleasant face contortions and nod occasionally while I try and work out what to do. In the distance, I hear Lecter crying out. Single-stringed moans of hunger and need. There's been no response from my ring. For all I can tell, it's a piece of inert jewellery. I can tell her the instrument is cursed until I go blue in the face. It won't help. The assistant commissioner has a PhD in criminology and runs on Home Office dictated rails. She doesn't hold with antiquated beliefs in curses or intrinsically evil instruments, and I doubt she can sight-read sheet music well enough to know what the King in Yellow is all about. Hand her a tool that can install a rootkit in 20 million brains, and she doesn't see any risk that isn't outweighed by the promise of installing a police state machine in those heads. She's running out of exhortations and starting to look at me askance, as if wondering why I'm not agreeing with her more enthusiastically. I'm out of time. It's feasible in principle, I admit reluctantly. The trouble is, the violin is very hard to control. I don't think so. She stands up. I've read your personnel file. You're the most powerful wielder that instrument has had in decades. You've outlasted all but one of your predecessors, haven't you? You can sight read. I'm assured it's not a very complicated piece. For its impact, it depends as much on the instrument as on the score. But I can't, or don't want to, she demands sharply. Dr. O'Brien, I'm not asking you to play that sonata, I'm ordering you to. But... Keith, Martin, get her on stage. She addresses the armed cops on the door. Interval's nearly over, and she's on next. To me. You will do as I say. She says, holding up the letter, the words on the page crawling before my eyes as with blue fire. By the power vested in me, I command and compel you. And as the gash on the page gets its fingers into my head, I feel myself standing involuntarily, grip tightening on my violin case. I turn towards the door, unable to help myself. Jim will hold the score for you, she tells me. Now, get up there and do your job, officer. I can't stop myself. And as my feet carry me towards the steps leading up to the back of the stage in the Albert Hall, unready and unwilling to give the performance of my life. I work out why. The gash working against me is my own oath of office. I was lawfully assigned to the security service, and thence to the Home Office. So Deputy Commissioner Stanwyck is lawfully able to order me to do this, with authority right from the top of my secondment. It'd take the SA himself suspending me from active duty to break me out of this trap. And in the meantime, I'm climbing the stairs with Lecter crooning tuneless alien phrases in the back of my mind. And then, the spotlight leads my unwilling feet towards the violin soloist's podium. And I'm out of time. Chapter 19. The King in Yellow. That nightmare I had, weeks ago, about performing naked on stage at the Albert Hall in front of an audience of empty police uniforms? Too realistic for comfort. The nascent sense of panic is chokingly familiar. There's no escape through waking up this time around. As I walk out onto the stage, past the percussion, then forward to the strings, I can't see the audience. We're lit brightly from above, but the whistles and chatter and applause and the crackle of party poppers all take place beyond the footlights. There's a burst of clapping as I walk towards the front, and the odd appreciative wolf whistle. The other musicians are in formal concert black. The soloists in evening gowns and tuxes. Our conductor in white tie and tails. My superhero drag marks me out as if I was naked. There's a music stand waiting for me. Jim stands stiffly beside it, perspiration glistening on his forehead. The other violinists look at me with ill-concealed incredulity as an announcer hurries up to the conductor, and they confer quietly. I can't break out of this walking nightmare, however hard I try. I find my hands are full, busily unlocking my violin case and extracting the bow and body without my conscious volition getting a look in. Fuck it, Mary, where are you? Why aren't you here? I glance at Jim. Maybe I can talk to him. Jim? He doesn't make eye contact. He looks slightly glassy, swaying in place as if anchored to the ocean floor in the grip of a watery current. Another gash? Jim! Snap out of it! His hand reaches out towards the music stand, adjusts the somewhat tattered brown-covered score that waits for me, and Lecter snarls, triumphant. The young, incredibly pretty, and astonishingly talented soloist who carried me away with her brilliance during the first half. She's barely 20 and she's already better than I'll ever be. Leans towards me and peers at my instrument in perplexity. Who made this? She asks, raising one perfectly threaded eyebrow. I haven't seen one of these before. I manage to tear my eyes away from the cover of the score and stare at her. If you value your life, run! I hiss at her, and she recoils, eyes wide. I mean it. Get out now before it's too late. I raise my bow and lay it across Lecter's strings, and he responds, just a faint ripple of lightning blue running up and down the fingerboard, which is incredibly sensitive tonight. Who are you? She asks. Trafalgar Square, the mayor, remember? Things are going to break bad. Get as many people out as you can. The lights are going down on the audience, and the background of noise changes. Jim is still swaying slightly, and after a moment, I realize he isn't blinking. Faint tear tracks run down his cheeks, but that's an autonomic reflex. If you've done anything to him, I warn Lecter, I'll... Not me. Lecter sounds awfully smug. Play now? His anticipation fills me with an awful, dull foreboding. Beside the conductor, the announcer clears his throat, then raises a cordless microphone. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to announce a change of programme for the second half. He pauses. You could hear a pin drop. Changes of programme are not normal during the last night of the proms. We will, of course, be concluding the evening as usual with a round of Roll Britannia, then Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance March No. 1 in D Major, Jerusalem and the National Anthem. But first, we have something very special for you tonight. It has never been played before in a concert hall. Indeed, the score of this piece was thought to have been lost until barely a month ago. A copy came to light in the Rare Manuscripts Archive during the clean-up after the mad scientist Professor Freudstein's robbery of the British Library. Some of you may have heard of a famously obscure play called The King in Yellow. It was in part the subject of a television crime drama last year. The King in Yellow was converted to an opera but never performed in full. Franz Kafka prepared the libretto and a score was subsequently written by his collaborator, the violinist Erik Zahn, for performance on specially adapted instruments of his own devising. But the rise of fascism put an end to all attempts to perform it until after the war. During the early 1960s, Delia Derbyshire of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop attempted to rescore the concerto for electronic instruments, but the controversial nature of the piece resisted attempts to bring it to a mainstream audience. Until now, that is. With the recovery of the original score, we are delighted to present, for the first time, the extraordinary violin sonata from the second act that marked the zenith of Erik Zahn's career. Our special guest soloist for tonight is Dr. Dominique O'Brien, lecturer in music at Birkbeck College, who was not only a leading authority on atonality in modernist composition during the Weimar period, but a talented soloist in her own right, and one of the few musicians who performs with an original Zahn instrument. Accompanying her on percussion, wind, and brass is the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, while elements of the text will be narrated as prose by... Jim reaches out jerkily, as if not in control of his own arm muscles, and turns back the cover to reveal the first page. My nerveless feet shuffle sideways, positioning me before the stand. I turn to face the invisible audience, wishing that my own superpower would manifest right now and vanish me from their purview, wishing the very earth would open up beneath my feet and swallow me. My guts are loose with fear. This is not stage fright, but something far, far worse. The sum of all my nightmares. I can't stop myself. I read the bracketed staves of the first line, see how the movement begins with the wind section, and where I am supposed to come in. A will not my own compels me to seat my instrument properly between shoulder and chin, and pushing past my terror, brushing my pathetic resistance aside, Lecter takes control of my wrists and fingertips. My traitor hands begin to play. I have been playing the violin since I was 8 years old, and I've practiced virtually every day with Lecter for the past decade. I've published papers on the intersection of music theory and occult inference systems. I came to the attention of the laundry for my research, and the Black Chamber too. So I know whereof I speak, when I say that music has power. I also know what I'm on about when I assert, with some certainty, that while I am a reasonably proficient musician, I am in no way up to the standard of a guest soloist performing before the last night audience at the Albert Hall. Third violin, maybe, at a pinch. If I really worked at it, and the orchestra director was hard up for talent. On the other hand, I'm probably the only violinist in the country who can both sight-read the particular score in front of me and understand what it's saying on all levels. The musical phrasing and the deeper expressions it invokes. The first page is light enough, an introduction in a minor key that gives me time to warm up. But soon enough, Jim turns the page before me, and we're into a much stronger exposition. Two themes, alternating from F minor to D flat major, with a subtext that makes my skin crawl and itch, as if tiny insects are burrowing beneath the surface, for I recognise the pattern of an invocation when I see one. My instrument's strings glow almost invisibly in the spotlight glare, but I can feel Lecter's power gathering in a rush as he awakens. From the corner of one eye, I can just see the soprano soloist taking breath as she prepares to give voice to Casilda's lament beside the turbid waters of the Lake of Hali.
"My turn," Lecter hums, overwhelmingly satisfied,
like a gigantic predator that is gathering himself to pounce on the fattest, juiciest prey. What will this do? I can't stop reading. My fingers refuse to still themselves. The gesh has me enchained. But sight reading doesn't quite take all my attention.
"I return to myself thus wise."
I glimpse a vision through the eyes of Lecter's interior space, and it is truly frightening. The stony amphitheatre of my earlier dream is superimposed over the stage of the Royal Albert Hall. The ceiling has disappeared, revealing a clear sky pierced by the lights of 1,000 alien stars. Around me, an orchestra of the dead plays for an audience of the damned.
"Who are you?"
Lecter laughs, the madness of strings.
"I am an echo of an echo, ripped from yellowing bones, enrobed in shrouds, to dance within this rigid body. Do you know me yet?"
The violin in my hands feels alive by proxy. As the piece moves back to the major theme, I feel him, warm and pulsing with stolen life, all the lives he's drunk down over the years and decades since the mad luthier of Munich bound a summoned demon into an instrument carved from the still raw bones of human sacrifices.
"Are you the king in yellow?"
I demand, as Jim, somnambulant, turns the page, and our little songbird at the podium raises her voice in song.
"I am no more the king in yellow than your littlest fingernail is the bearer of the white violin. But soon..."
Then, the development steps up a level, and I can't spare any attention for horrified contemplation. My fingers and hands and arms and upper body are all caught up in the progression, as the chorus join in song, chanting lyrics increasingly mutilated and warped to serve the ends of Freudstein. "Strange is the night where black stars rise, and strange moons circle through the skies. But stranger still is lost Carcosa. Songs of law the Hyades shall sing, where flap the tatters of the king, must die unheard in dim Carcosa. Bind those who hear these words to love the law though death itself shall die. Unquestioning, obedient, in dim Carcosa." The Albert Hall has completely disappeared. I seem to stand amidst a frozen orchestra as the music dies away around us. Jim is frozen beside the music stand, a puppet in the hands of a tired master. His eyes glow faintly with the spiraling worm sign of feeders in night. The audience, on the stone steps of the amphitheatre, are familiar. Prom-goers, transported bodily to the alien place, immobile in the grip of some force that has stopped time itself. I look up at where the ceiling should be, and see moons. Two of them, shining down like symbols of merciless alienation. My hands are empty. I jerk round, half-panicked, a sense of helpless vulnerability. I know in retrospect this sounds laughable, gripping me. Because the violin is my most powerful defence, and Lecter vanished just as I found myself on this stony stage. But then I realise what's going on.
Looking for me?
I dry swallow, looking up at Lecter's true form. Not really, I say, in a very small voice, trembling slightly.
Too bad.
In this place, Lecter doesn't wear the body of a bone-white violin. He doesn't need to. I know where we are. Previously, he's invaded my dreams, but now, flushed with the power of a major summoning, he's dragged me into his dream. Now I know what to look for. I can feel ghost fingers moving, the tension of neck and shoulder betraying a performance still in progress.
I couldn't risk you refusing to cooperate further with my little joke.
The gaunt figure, floating in mid-air before me, seems to smirk, even though its face is hidden from my perception by a veil of palest golden lace.
So, I thought I'd invite you backstage with me, while your body plays on without you.
This is where you live, isn't it? I glance away. Around us, the frozen figures stand, row upon row, eyes flickering with tainted phosphorescence. This is where you've always been.
I'm the last one, you know. The last surviving key. All the other violins are lost, destroyed, or locked away. All but me.
Yes. I turn back to face him. It. Him. The avatar of that which the pale violins were created to summon, when the stars were right. Lecter's shadow, the king in yellow, released from captivity within the body of the bone violin. There are people who really don't think you should exist anymore. Did you know that?
I am aware.
His amusement is icy.
But once the key turns in the lock, I shall come into my full birthright, and they will cease to be of concern.
Here I stand, trapped timeless in the gap between two beats of a measure, in a work of transcendental melodic magic that has been perverted into a summoning. Here I stand, caught inside the dreamscape of my own cursed musical instrument, while it seeks to pervert the perversion, to turn Operation Freudstein's insanely dangerous attempt at a mass gesh of compulsion into an invocation instead, a summoning for the King in Yellow. Here I stand, outside of time and space, and I notice that I'm shaking. I'm not in shock, and I am not cold, for there is no temperature in Lecter's dream. I am, I slowly realise, livid with anger and just barely bottling it in. Anger? Rage, actually. Let me enumerate the roots of my rage. I'm furious with Bob for deserting me to become the new Eater of Souls. I'm mortified and angry with myself for falling for Jim's charms while failing to realise that he'd been placed in my organisation, whether or not he knew it, by our adversary, to provide them with a continuous stream of intelligence about us via his weekly reports. Even before we come to my abduction into this waking nightmare, I was furious at my instrument for daring to tiptoe around my dreams and hopes and fears, resentful of the way it manipulated me with Mary. I'm pissed off at Dr. Armstrong for dumping me into the directorship at Incorrigible, also known as the Transhuman Police Coordination Force, a job for which I am absolutely inadequate and unqualified. But above and beyond that, I am disgusted with him for knowingly putting me in a position of assumed helplessness in hope that it would lead our enemy to play their hand. Despite being fully aware of my history of what unquiet ghosts it would dredge up. I'm upset at myself for being afraid of standing backlit against windows and for spooking at loud noises in crowds. I'm angry with all the waiters and shop assistants and police foot patrols who can look right at me and fail to see me as I slowly drown in the oceanic waters of social irrelevance, succumbing to the invisibility of the middle-aged woman until it gradually becomes a 3 or 4 sigma superpower. An expression of my own not inconsiderable strength as a practitioner feeding on my sense of self-doubt and inadequacy. The Invisible Man is a Wellesian supervillain, but the invisible women are all around us, anxious and unseen. I lack the words to adequately express how incensed I am by the activities of Deputy Commissioner Laura Stanwyck of the Metropolitan Police and her cronies within ACPO, who have decided on their own initiative that Nanny knows best, and that creating a nightmare supervillain as a stalking horse to justify raping 20 million minds in parallel is a perfectly acceptable price to pay, if it improves cooperation with the police in a time of national crisis. A crisis that they barely understand and are in no small measure unintentionally contributing to by diverting our scarce resources. That the culmination of Operation Freudstein is an attempt to compel millions of people to obey the rules of policing is bad enough. That they've recklessly chosen to ignore my urgent warnings about the risks of overfeeding the white violin is worse. That the instrument in question sees this as an opportunity to become the undead avatar of the King in Yellow, and is well on the way to doing just that, if I'm any judge of demonic summonings gone wrong, is just unspeakable. But all of this is displacement. The harsh fact is, I don't much like who I've become or what I've done with my life since I followed Bob down the rabbit hole of the laundry all those years ago. I have, admittedly, had all those extra years of life and even some stretches of something approximating marital bliss. I can't forget the way Bob rescued me twice from fates that don't bear thinking about. Admittedly, I returned the favour. We've played a hair-raisingly extreme version of For Better or For Worse over the years. But it's been crumbling for ages now, as I was sent on one nightmarish job after another, culminating in Vakilabad and then the nonsense in Trafalgar Square. History repeats itself, first as tragedy and then as farce. I've sacrificed a lot to the laundry. I allowed my academic career to wither, marking time in a teaching niche. Kids? Well, they were a non-starter once I understood the horrifying implications of Case Nightmare Green. Salary? Don't get me started. I'm in my 40s now, my best years behind me, marriage coming unravelled, career tanking spectacularly, and when the chips were down, the oath of office I swore rendered me unable to say no to the most heinously immoral order anyone has ever given me. My self-respect has taken a battering from these successive betrayals of trust. But I'm still angry. And as long as I'm not numb, I've got something to work with. And more to the point, I think Lecter has inadvertently given me a way out. There is this thing about my oath of office. I'm sworn to the defence of the realm, and I'm sworn to obey lawful orders. That's the horrible thing about Laura Stanwyck's having served me with notice under Part 2 of the Civil Contingencies Act, signed by the Home Secretary, after the SA helpfully seconded me to the Home Office. It's entirely lawful, because the CCA is essentially an enabling act that allows designated emergency commanders to make it up as they go along. It was designed to ensure continuity of operations in event of a major catastrophe, such as a nuclear war, and I'm helpless to refuse it, because the gesh built into my oath of office requires me to obey lawful orders. But the sorcerers who devised the gesh weren't stupid. I have some latitude in how I interpret an order. Laura Stanwyck ordered me to go on stage with the white violin and play the sonata from The King in Yellow before a live audience. But she didn't order me to help Lecter unlock the astral gate and summon his master. That's the instrument's agenda, not the home office at work. And more prosaically, she forgot to order me not to do anything else. In that frozen moment, standing in the middle of the amphitheatre of dreams in Lecter's memory of long-lost Carcosa, I realise what I have to do. I draw on what willpower I have, and slip sideways, away from even this shadow of reality. Lecter's spectral outline shifts, drifting towards me. I take a step back, then another.
Where have you gone?
I can feel my invisibility like a cloak I can tug around myself. I take a step sideways, towards Jim's frozen image. The glowing eyes. He's not possessed yet, not quite. He's just open to possession. If Lecter comes into his full power and erupts, unleashing a tidal wave of hunger across the stage. I reach around his shoulders and shroud him in my imaginary cloak.
What are you doing? Reveal yourself at once.
A voice of thunder rattles from the stone steps around us, hammering my ears. Jim's body is rigid as stone, stiff, unbreathing in this place, an instant between heartbeats. The thing that is Lecter pounds away across the stage, bowling through the oboes and clarinets like a vengeful fury, scattering mannequin musicians in all directions.
Come back!
He howls, distracted. Good. I can't feel my fingers properly. That's also a good sign. It means the illusion he's woven to trap me here is slipping slightly. I lean in close, towards Jim's face. Jim! Jim! Wake up! Snap out of it! Something changes. He doesn't move, doesn't respond. But after a moment, I realise he's breathing. Trapped in this place with me outside time. Jim! If this were a fairy tale, I'd have to kiss him or something. But, unfortunately, the real world is a whole lot more complicated. And I am not going there until Officer Friendly and I have had a free and frank exchange of opinions about loyalty. So instead, I kick him on the right shin. Hard.
Ow!
Jim staggers, the luminosity fading from his eyes.
Ah! Ow! Mo, we're all... Get down!
I grab him again, stretching my shroud, and drag him to the ground as Lecter howls and shrieks overhead, blotting out the moons as he flies across the arena.
Where are... Shut up!
I hiss. It takes concentration to extend my imaginary cloak around others, but I've done it before. I did it for Busy Bee in Downing Street. I can do it for Jim here. Listen, we're awake in Lecter's dreamscape. Stanwyck thinks if I play this sonata with the modified lyrics, she can turn a third of the population into obedient little constables. Lecter has other ideas, and if I finish it, we're in a world of hurt. That? There is a pale silver ovoid glimmering in the air at the far side of the stage. A portal of a kind I've seen before, and really don't want to be seeing here. Is Lecter attempting to summon his superior avatar, the King in Yellow? Oh, shit. Is that... Yes. Shut up. In a moment you're going to wake up on stage again, and you've got to stop me playing. Do you understand? I grab his shoulders, wrap my arms around him. I stare into his eyes and see the confusion bleed away, replaced by worried concern. Mo, can't you... Laura hit me with a gash. Do you know the story, The Red Shoes? Someone else has to stop me.
But I...
He looks sick.
I'm really sorry. I had no idea she was planning...
Another mournful howl splits the air. Lecter, soars high above the ruins of Carcosa, searching for his runaway host. You want me to stop you playing? Got it, I say. And try not to use your superpowers. If you use them here, it could be really bad. That would attract the feeders, like sending up an occult signal saying, K-syndrome fast food Buffy here. He's hugging me back. And because we're trapped between ticks of the clock and a dream of desolate ruins, I lean close to him and kiss him on the lips once, by way of a goodbye. And as I feel him respond, we fade to standing spotlit on a stage, wrists and shoulders feeling pierced by hot wires and blood trickling down my stinging fingertips to lubricate the blue humming strings of the white violin. As I face the music in the Albert Hall, the bow dragging my hand back and forth as the tempo increases and the chorus raise their voices in an unearthly counterpoint.
Found you.
Lecter shrieks inside my head as my right ring finger buzzes emphatically, and I sense, rather than see, a great tattered bat shape flapping towards me out of the darkness beyond the lights. Then Jim makes his move, and all hell breaks loose. For a split second, Jim stands beside me, white-gloved, hand hovering over the corner of the score from which my bleeding hands are compelled to play. Then he grabs the manuscript and jumps. I told him not to, but of course, silly me, my mojo is all about being ignored. I gape, following his leap. Any lingering doubt that Jim is indeed officer friendly vanishes after him as I follow his trajectory towards the dress circle boxes.
Come back!
Lecter howls in my head, deafening me. But the gesh is broken. With no musical score, I can't continue the performance. I slowly turn towards the orchestra, lowering my bow as a steady trickle of blood runs down the fingerboard of my instrument and splatters to the floor. There's something wrong with the bow, I realize dimly. My finger vibrates again, an urgent imperative. Faces look at me. And these eyes are indeed glowing. Writhing blue-green worms twirling within the heads of people who no longer exist in any human sense of the word. The instrument feels dead. It feels like a violin made of bone. The anima that gave it such a vibrant sense of life has departed. No. It's not dead. Rather, I'm keeping an iron grip on my own visibility because something in the back of my head is terrified that Lecter will notice me again. I've blocked him out completely. As long as he can't see me, his attention will be turned elsewhere. But that might not be a good thing. All around me stand the bodies of orchestra and proms goers, occupied by the lesser feeders in the night for whom the recital has opened the way. Mindless processes of contagion and possession that swirl in the wake of the greater summonings and seek living bodies to run on. Allowed to swarm in because Laura Stanwyck wouldn't take no for an answer and didn't let me fully explain the risks of a recital with the white violin so close to breaking loose. And in a moment, they're going to realize that I'm not one of them. The words oh and dear spring to mind. I often find myself wishing for my husband, most frequently for trivial reasons ranging from mere comforting conversation to kitchen sink side assistance. But right now, I could really use him. If Bob was here, putting down an incursion of a few thousand hungry feeders in the night would be a non-problem. That's the sort of thing the Eater of Souls does. Again, if things stood as they did 6 months ago, when I was still in control of my instrument and Lecter damn well did as he was told, this would be a non-problem. But not only am I no longer with my husband, I am hiding from my instrument's attention because he seems intent on turning me into a tool of his own will. So, I appear to be stranded in the middle of a zombie mosh pit with 1,000 or more feeder-possessed bodies, a numb violin, a dysfunctional superhero costume, and only my own talent to fall back on. I just hope the feeders aren't paying attention to the bat signal right now, because if they are, I'm done for. Tightening my invisibility around me like a cloak, I carefully step sideways towards the soloist's seat. I'm really glad to see that she listened to me and left. I think I can do this. The possessed are still focused on where I stood a moment ago, and they're not actually moving. Maybe they can't see me. No, they're tracking me. Or rather, they're tracking the thing I'm carrying. They're tracking Lecter. This goes beyond an oh dear moment. I analyze my options, and this is what I get. I can get out of here on my own. They can't see me any more than anyone else who I don't want to be seen by can see me. But if I scuttle away, I'll be leaving several thousand promgoers in thrall to whatever brain-eating parasites Lecter has invited to the party. I'll also be leaving a truly hideous mess for the first responders when they arrive on scene. What I should do is try to banish them. But I can't do that without my instrument's cooperation. Or can I? I look up at the shadowy recesses of the ceiling. Jim's up there somewhere, isn't he? He took the score. I can only hope he's got the sense to run away, that the feeders didn't notice him, and that the high-power ward I upgraded him to is strong enough to protect him as long as Lecter can't see him directly. My belt pouch vibrates. A moment later, the ring on my right hand contracts painfully, pulsing twice. This had better be important. I reach into my pouch and quickly glance at my phone. There's a text message from Mary. My knees go weak. "We're coming in. Can you distract them?" I tap out a reply with shaking fingers. "We'll try." I hit send, then shove my phone back in the pouch and look around. The second violin sits slumped forward, eyes glowing. Her instrument has fallen at her feet, unnoticed. I pick up her stand and score. My fingertips feel as if they've been burned, and I leave a reddish smear on everything I touch, especially the papers. Careful not to brush up against any of the possessed, I pick my way past the immobile players and walk towards the concert grand parked at the side of the stage. I'm in luck. The lid is down. The pianist not yet on stage to play his part of the programme. I climb onto the stool, then boost myself up onto the top of the horribly expensive instrument, trying not to think about what my boots are doing to its finish, but for what I'm going to do next. I need a raised platform with a good view in all directions, the better to see my audience. I set up the stand, open the score, and raise my instrument. Mine, not Lecter's. It's still the same bone-white body, made from materials nobody in their right mind would inquire too closely about, but there's no sense of his attention hovering around it. Lecter, the entity bound into the body, is elsewhere right now. No time to check whether this is safe. I've just got to hope that it works. I flip through the score, looking for what I need. Stanwyck's inadvisable editing of the second half of the night's programme replaced a medley of popular pieces with The King in Yellow. But she didn't touch the traditional closing sequence. Even to a manipulative Philistine like her, rearranging the traditional end of the last night concert qualifies as sacrilege or treason or both. So I cut straight to the climax. First up in the sequence is Ansel's Plymouth Hoe, a nautical overture. But there's precious little I can do with it with just one violin. I could run through the main theme, but it's light on strings and heavy on the brass and winds. So I flip past it and go straight to Rule Britannia. Now that's scored for strings. I'll have to improvise a bit, and I can't count on any support from the chorus, who are peering green-eyed and silent in the direction of Lecter's body. But it's really hard to mess up something so deeply ingrained in anyone who learned violin in a British secondary school. it's traditionally followed by Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance, March No. 1 in D minor, better known as Land of Hope and Glory. Then Jerusalem. The proms are really big on Elgar, finishing with the national anthem. "This had better be worth it, Mary," I mutter. I'm terrified that I'm going to get this wrong. That's what comes of paying too much attention to my own fear and self-doubt. I've got to do this, got to get it right the first time. I take a deep breath, and I start to play, my fingertips sore and bleeding across strings that remain stubbornly dark. The sound of one violin playing in a concert venue the size of the Albert Hall is a lonely thing. But there is none of the usual quiet side chat, shuffling and laughter you'd expect from a regular audience. As I begin, you could hear a pin drop. Normally, the audience would be on their feet, brandishing banners and singing along with the lead soloist and the BBC chorus. It's the nearest thing you'll get to an American-style display of hyper-patriotic flag-waving from the normally reticent British. But this isn't a normal concert audience. As I play, I look around at my audience. They're cold. Cold as the grave. Thousands of pairs of pale green glowing eyes focus on the thing in my hands. Their bodies standing immobile, trapped within shells of flesh. I can't even tell if they're still alive or if their souls have already been eaten. Part of me is still concentrating on my invisibility, fearful that if I relax my focus, Lecter will notice me. If he wins again, I'll have to play, and I won't be able to stop until my hands are bleeding stumps, no longer able to hold bow to string. Heads begin to turn, one by one at first. Then, in a wave of iridescence that flashes across the floor of the hall. Something is happening behind me, but I don't dare look round. I have to keep the music flowing. But it's hard to concentrate on playing and to withhold myself from visibility at the same time. The need to remain unseen is the antithesis of the performative impulse.
"Stop it. Stop it now."
Lecter has finally noticed me. My fingertips burn as the strings and bow light up with blue-green fire, spiralling whorls of light that echo the gaze of the possessed. Is it my imagination? Or does he sound frightened? Querulous? "Not going to stop," I hum quietly along to the score.
"You must not do this. Where is the score? Where has he taken it?"
"Don't know. Don't care. We're going to finish this, Lecter. We're going to bring this back to the last night of the proms, and you're going to make all your little friends go away." Somehow, I managed to flip the page without smearing blood all over it.
"I've won, you know."
The voice in my head bleeds menace.
"Eat them all."
If you eat the audience, I can promise you an eternity of torment. The auditors won't stop me. You can go too far, you know. Before me, the audience sway gently. One by one, they begin to raise their arms. I don't dare to hope they're possessed after all. This might just be Lecter directing them to act in unison. But I feel his attention drifting from me. No. Something is wrong. Something I didn't anticipate. But what? At first, I think the stage lights are coming up. But then I realize the shadow of my leg stretching out before me is being cast from a single source, directly behind me, rather than overhead. I turn to face the light and falter. Recover. Then force myself to keep playing, even though I desperately want to flee.
"Carcosa,"
Lecter tells me.
"Where the king in yellow waits."
It's a gate. Circular. Perhaps 5 meters in diameter, its rim burning with a pale limelight fire as it stretches across the stage in front of the organist's pit. Beyond it, I see a shadowy stage. Dreadfully familiar rows of cracked stone seats rising up in the amphitheatre beyond. Other performers on stage, white-shrouded, their features invisible as they dance and sway to inaudible music, performed at the command of one who is not.